This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome, beloved listeners, to another week of the Little Wireless program. It seems only yesterday that Kerry-Ann Kennelly was warning that a Labour victory in the federal election would end civilization as we know it, a view echoed and perhaps amplified by Alan Jones, who swore that in that terrible event he would forswear further broadcasting. Well, fortunately, Australia dodged that bullet. In fact, it's dodged an asteroid somewhat bigger than the Brinny that wiped out all those big goannas. And a little later in the program, well, just in just a moment's time, I'll be talking to Laura Tingle about matters arising, because all sorts of things are taking place as a consequence of the victory. Then I'm going to introduce you to a charming woman, Daniela Gavshon. And she's going to tell us why, after 10 years since the end of the Sri Lankan Civil War, there's been no proper investigation of the atrocities carried out by the various parties to the conflict. And at the end of the program, looking more Christ-like than ever, George Gittos comes back to us. George, as you know, has worked in Nicaragua, Rwanda, Somalia, Cambodia, the Gaza Strip, Afghanistan. But he thinks that working in Chicago was perhaps the most challenging and even dangerous experience he's ever had. He will report to us from a place called Chirac, a very interesting name to give to a Chicago suburb. Ladies and gentlemen, be upstanding for Laura Tingle. Laura, so much is happening. Can you tell us about the new cabinet appointed at the weekend?
Oh, well, it's an interesting one, Philip. It sort of reflects, I mean, it's a natural extension of where we've got to with politics, I suppose, which is, the Prime Minister's now just trying to settle everything down after the election. Everybody's sort of been patching up their differences in Parliament House, and he's put together a cabinet which is essentially got all the same players in the really big jobs like Treasury, Foreign Affairs, Attorney General, all that sort of stuff. But there have been some tweaks which have meant that there are a lot more women in the cabinet, a record number of women. The first Indigenous person to hold the Indigenous Affairs portfolio has been appointed.
Forgive me for interrupting, but that's one appointment which has been met with universal approval.
Ken Wyatt's appointment? Yes, I think that's right. I think they're all really good things, the Prime Minister's emphasising that he wants to focus on service delivery, and that means trying to make the NDIS work better, trying to get all those things like childcare support and all those sorts of sort of services that people get frustrated about to function better. So he's starting on a very practical level, but there've been a few important symbols put out there, which I think, apart from anything else, do sort of give a little bit of ground to the sort of place that Labor was trying to pull the country a bit on, things like Indigenous affairs. But having said that, things like constitutional recognition, the issue of a voice for Indigenous Australia, this being Reconciliation Day, Philip, so they're relevant points, they're still in the works somewhere and a bit further down the track.
Also in the works is the move of Arthur Synodinos to Washington. Now, I must say, that's a hell of a comeback for Arthur, who not so long ago was embroiled in a bit of a scandal with Sydney Water.
Well, he was, but I don't think anything ever really stuck to Arthur on that. I think I actually have a great regard for Arthur Synodinos amongst the constellation of people that you strike in Canberra, and I think it's a really good appointment. Whatever the question about jobs for the boys might be, he's a very good person to put into that job. The question is, can the Morrison government spare him from here? Because he's a great strategist, he's a great policy person, and I think the cabinet is weaker for him not being in it.
What about Mitch Fifield getting the UN?
Yes, well, that's a little bit less clear. The Prime Minister insists that Mitch Fifield was keen to move on, but of course, one of the arrangements that comes about from these two appointments, Philip, is it magically opens up two Senate vacancies, which helps reduce the tensions in the Liberal Party before and since the election. And the expectation is that Jim Molan, who you might recall, was somewhat unpleased about being dropped off the Senate ticket to an unwinnable position and then kicked up a stink, which created all sorts of troubles with the Nationals, is sort of expected
to get personally terribly thrilled about this.
I knew you would be, Philip. And Sarah Henderson, who lost the seat of Corangamite down Geelong way, announced today that she would be nominating herself for the Senate vacancy that would be coming up when Mitch Fifield presumably goes off to the UN in a couple of months' time.
If I might swing the spotlight across to what's left of the opposition, I note that Albo was the only candidate left standing.
He was, and I think this is one of the really interesting developments out of the fallout of this election campaign, Philip. And the part of the reason for that was, you'll remember that when Bill Shorten became leader, it was because there was the new process that Kevin Rudd had set up where there was going to be if it was a contested leadership ballot, the party membership got to have a say in it, but the caucus also got to have a say. Albo won the popular vote, but Shorten had the numbers in the caucus. Now, this time round, with, shall we say, the authority of everybody knowing that he had that popular support, which probably hadn't changed, Anthony Albanese essentially said, well, I'm running and the right will just have to work out what they're going to do about it. It's the right faction. It all got a little bit almost threateningly unpleasant because the word went out that Bill Shorten was going back to being a faction man and organising against Albo for the right. And we had this really interesting thing happen where the really sane heads in the parliamentary party, Tony Burke, who of course is from the New South Wales right, Penny Wong, who's an incredibly well-regarded Senate leader, and others made it clear that this was not a good way of maintaining the regard that former Labor leaders normally have. And I think it essentially broke up the support base in the right, because it looked like the right would split. So we saw Chris Bowen first put his hand up and then put it down again. Jim Chalmers do the same. So it ended up being an uncontested ballot, which I think is a really great outcome. And people within the caucus have said to me, apart from anything else, we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just seen as yet another dirty right-left brawl and deal. And so not only do we have a leader from the left emerging, which is pretty unusual, but we have one who's had support across the factions, or at least parts of the factions, and it isn't just a trade-off. Though, of course, it looks like somebody from the right will get the deputy's job.
I would have been handing out how-to-vote cards for Penny Wong, except for the small problem of her being in the Senate and not wanting the job.
That's right. And while a lot of us have the most immense regard for Penny Wong, we also have the most immense respect for her, knowing that it's not the world's most pleasant job being the party leader.
So Albo thinks his most difficult task is to convince us that Labor is ready to govern. Doesn't Scott Morrison also have that problem?
Look, I think, that's a really interesting way of putting it, Philip. I hadn't thought of it that way. But, yeah, I think Scott Morrison has really got to reset the clock and say to people, look, yes, it's all been a bit unpleasant. Yes, we knifed a Prime Minister. Yes, we're all very divided. Yes, we had a lot of policies which we couldn't actually agree upon. So he's got the capacity to reset the clock, if you like. And Anthony Albanese's got a longer task. He's got 3 years to try to persuade people about that. And I think it's going to be interesting. I think if you think about where Labor ended up with its policy platform, it was very ambitious, and that was partly, and had all those extra taxes and things, and that was partly because, as I think we discussed last week, Bill Shorten needed that sort of policy sort of uniform to sort of counter or sort of embellish him, because he had this problem that people didn't like him. Didn't work, of course, and thing that Albo's got going in his favour is most people do like him. Whether they embrace him as Prime Minister is the next big question.
I've always thought that journalists who cover elections should get those little service ribbons that you see generals and admirals, you know, on their, wearing on their breast. But they're not available. What is available, however, and I don't think I've ever given you one before, is a koala stamp. So a koala stamp for Laura for her hard work during a very difficult time in Australian history. Laura being, of course, Chief Political Correspondent for 7:30. Coming up, reconciliation, or the lack of it, in Sri Lanka. While we were having our federal election on the 18th of May and all that excitement, you might have missed the significance of the date. It marks a decade since the official ending, if you like, of the civil war in Sri Lanka. After 25 years of bloodshed, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam were defeated in mid-May in 2009, and in the 10 years since, there's been no proper investigation of the atrocities carried out by the various parties to the conflict. Sitting opposite me in the studio, lawyer Daniela Gavshon. She's from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre and has just prepared a report documenting thousands of examples of human rights violations in Sri Lanka between 83 and 2009. And it's great to have her in the studio. Daniela, let's briefly rush through the periods really, because there are chapters, aren't there, clear chapters in the Sri Lankan Civil War. I guess it begins in 83 with the Black July riots.
Yeah, sure. So in 1983, you'd had escalating violence prior to that point between the majority Sinhalese community and the minority Tamil, and there were some militant groups that were emerging at that point. And in 1983, you had the Tamil Tigers, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, who ambushed and killed 13 government soldiers. In response to that, there was widespread rioting and thousands of people were displaced, hundreds of people killed, some say up to 1,000. There was two incidents in prisons where Tamil prisoners were killed by Sinhalese people, and that was really the outbreak of what people see as the outbreak of the war from 1983.
In 87, the Indian government arrives and, well, its soldiers arrive to keep the peace, but the Tigers resist the 45,000 Indian troops.
Mm. Yeah, so what happened there was you had the government of Sri Lanka brokered this the Indo-Lankan Accord with the Indian government brokered it with the Sri Lankan government, and the LTT weren't a party to that agreement and weren't happy that they were there. And one of the conditions of that agreement was that they would disarm. And so they started to fight between the Indian peacekeeping force and the LTTE. So there's a lot of human rights violations documented during that period. Some of them just civilians caught in the crossfire between the Indian peacekeeping force and the LTTE, some where civilians are allegedly targeted and disappeared and killed in that period.
In 1990, I remember that temporary truce between Sri Lankan government and the Tigers. And of course, in 1991, Indian President Rajiv Gandhi is killed by a Tamil Tiger suicide bomber.
Yes, and then you also had in 1993 then the Sri Lankan president was killed by a suicide bomber. So you start to see, again, an increasing amount of suicide attacks perpetrated by the LTTE against significant people, ministers and leaders and party leaders.
Between 1995 and 2002, there's intense fighting, and of course, this habit, this terrible practice of child abductions to recruit, if that's the word, child soldiers.
That was something that was done predominantly by the LTTE. There was one point there's allegedly a one-child policy where people were told that they had to give a child to the LTTE. The LTTE really were ramping up at that point. But what was happening was that you were having, these suicide attacks or these large-scale attacks by the LTTE, and then the government security forces were coming in and doing these really big cordon search operations to find the perpetrators. But at the same time, they were taking, lots and lots of young Tamil people into custody, held without any sort of charge or anything for really extended periods of time. And you've got lots of allegations of torture and ill treatment during that period as well by the government security forces.
What about the talks mediated by Norway?
So that was in 2002. Norway brokered a ceasefire agreement, and with that came a Sri Lankan monitoring mission, which was by a number of Nordic countries coming to monitor the peace. There are a number of different agreements that were part of that. But during that time, there were significant infractions on the peace agreement. The SLMM, the Sri Lankan Monitoring Mission, recorded over 4,000 infractions, mostly by the LTTE during that period. So some people say that it was a period where the LTTE took advantage to regroup and realign, militarise.
Between 2006 and 2009, the Tigers are pushed into smaller and smaller areas, and it's at this period that many of the worst crimes against humanity were committed.
Yeah, so that is definitely seen as the most violent and destructive part of the conflict, where you had the government was basically managing to recapture. Well, they recaptured the east and then were managing to recapture the north back from the LTTE. And you had all these civilians in this area who couldn't get out. So the LTTE weren't letting them out and the government weren't letting them through. And they were in an increasingly smaller and smaller area that was being shelled, allegedly indiscriminately. And there was nowhere to go.
LNL on RN. Download us wherever you get your podcast or listen on the ABC Listen app. My guest is Daniella Gavshon, a lawyer from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, and she's released a report documenting war crimes in the Sri Lankan Civil War that are still to be investigated properly. So, really, nothing much has been done, has it, about bringing criminals to book?
No. One of the things that we really are working on is supporting the transitional justice process there. So when a country has emerging from a period of conflict where there's been a massive amount of violations, like there has been in Sri Lanka, the legal system that we have, the regular legal system, isn't equipped to deal with what has happened. So a regular court can't deal with the massive violations. And so that's when we look to establish what we call transitional justice mechanisms.
But we saw this most spectacularly in South Africa, didn't we, with Truth and Reconciliation?
Yeah, so in South Africa you saw what's become quite a famous Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where you had a group of commissioners established to look into what happened in the conflict, why it happened, the root causes, establish the truth or the various narratives of what happened, and then present recommendations. So they do that with public hearings and taking statements from witnesses, and they bring that together in recommendations for a country on how to move forward.
Now, quite a few countries since then have tried to, have been inspired by the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa. Has it been successful in your view?
I think it has. I think it depends very much on the recommendations and how seriously they're taken up afterwards. I think the process itself is important, and the process is a healing process for people to get to tell their stories, to be heard, for a nation to pause and listen. But I think it very much then depends on how much the recommendations are then followed.
Did the South African example go far enough?
I think there's a lot of questions about the South African model, because they had a truth for amnesty formula. Most truth commissions don't actually have that, whereas when countries are looking to establish a truth commission, they look to the South African one, which is the famous one that did have amnesties. In that truth commission, there were over 5,000 applications for amnesty and only about 700 granted. So it didn't actually give as many amnesties as people think. And I think that has ended up giving a misleading view for people on how truth commissions work.
Is there a better model somewhere, Daniella?
I don't know if there's a better model, but I think probably the best model is to localise the model. So I think it's about not taking the South African model or one from Latin America where there have been a lot. It's about creating a model that fits for the country.
Okay, let's go back to Sri Lanka. Why hasn't it set up an appropriate judicial process?
So at the Human Rights Council, the Sri Lankan government did agree that in 2015 that they would set up a judicial mechanism and that they would have international involvement in that. They have since reneged on that very, very clearly and said that they would not have one with international involvement. I think that, you know, you still have a lot of people who are alleged to have been involved in war crimes and crimes against humanity holding significant positions of power. Or
let us just emphasise that the people who won the war are the people who might be prosecuted.
Yes, that's very much a possibility, and I think that that's something that obviously people in power do not want to happen.
So no wonder they keep changing the subject.
Exactly.
Can I just ask you to remind us of the demographics of Sri Lanka, the population breakup? It's overwhelmingly, I'm sorry, you do it.
It's overwhelmingly Sinhalese. So you have about 70% Sinhalese who are mostly Buddhist. And then you have about 15 to 17% Tamil. Tamil are mostly Hindu. And then you have about 11% Muslim. And then you have probably about 10% Christian, but they're made up of Tamil and Sinhalese.
So it's a mosaic, isn't it? You're looking at very, very complex interrelationships.
Exactly. Very different religions, ethnicities, cultures within the one island.
Which makes it all the harder to put together some sort of mechanism that where justice is done and seen to be done.
It does make it harder, but it also makes not dealing with it even more of a problem, because there are ethnic divides and there are tensions that haven't been addressed.
How could Sri Lanka set up an appropriate process in your view?
I think if it follows what it committed to in the Human Rights Council. So I think if it has already set up an office on missing persons, which is a really good step forward, but it has not set up, it's only just starting to set up an office of reparations, but it's taking a while. And I think if it sets up a truth commission and does have a judicial mechanism with international involvement where it is able to be seen as impartial and legitimate, then I think that could go some way to making progress.
I'm right, aren't I, that your report has identified 2,500 human rights violations?
Yes, our report is based on a database that we created from over 6,000 documents, all publicly available documents, and we have about 4,500 incidents in the database, and then we have, in the report, we have sought to give a sample of those, so there's about 2,000 violations.
But there could be thousands more.
Yes, this is just publicly reported, so things like sexual violence, torture, those sorts of things are not publicly reported in the same way, so there would be way more. There's allegedly between 60 and 100,000 people who disappeared during the conflict.
How many?
60,000 to 100,000 people since the 80s, according to Amnesty.
Oh dear, oh dear. How might your report help future Sri Lankan polis who may wish to bring about a national healing?
Well, so our report's known as a conflict mapping report, and conflict maps are really useful in advocating for a transitional justice process to begin or to continue. And so it shows the widespread violations that have occurred, how broadly it's affected people, how there's often contested truths about what happened. And so it's essentially the evidence to say this is something really, really awful that's happened and we need to do something about this.
It's interesting, isn't it, that there are quite a few ethnically Tamil Sri Lankan asylum seekers in Australia. And I understand about 6 years ago, lawyers from your centre began interviewing them and started collecting evidence.
Mm, so we did that. We released a report in 2014 called Island of Impunity, where we had looked at the final Island of Impunity. And we looked at the final 8 months of the conflict, and we had interviewed dozens of witnesses in Australia who had escaped the conflict. And we realised they had so much evidence to give and so much information to share. And so we started collecting that and then put that together in a report in 2014.
This is a huge undertaking. How much funding do you have, and where do you get it from?
We are well funded. We get funding from international donors, predominantly. We don't take any money from sort of, you know, Sri Lankan, Tamil or Sinhalese groups, because we like to remain impartial. But, you know, overseas philanthropic groups have got a big grant from the Oak Foundation in the past and other big donors.
And you get a lot of pro bono help.
So that's probably the most valuable resource that we get. So because we're part of an established community legal centre, the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, we have great networks in the legal community. And so we've had a significant amount of pro bono help from lawyers at top tier law firms who have sat there scouring documents for us, entering them into the database and really been the people power behind a project like this.
Now, on Easter Sunday, there was a shocking terrorist attack that killed over 300 people.
Mm.
Was that related to the Civil War?
It's a hard question. I think certainly the Easter Sunday attacks came as a massive shock. I think people weren't expecting them. And I think the difficulty in reconciling it is that until then, there had been a lot of violence directed towards the Muslim community or with the Muslim community, Tamil and Muslim community, but the Muslim community generally had not been known to be a violent or extremist community at all in Sri Lanka. And so it is very different to see Muslim community attacking the Christian population who very much has not been an active part of the conflict at all. But it does go to show the inter-ethnic and inter-communal issues and the need to address these issues and the need for accountability.
Marvellous work, and I thank you very much for coming onto the program, Daniela. Daniela Gavshon, lawyer from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, who's released the report documenting war crimes in the Sri Lankan Civil War that way overdue being properly investigated. This is LNL on RN, and a doppelganger for Jesus Christ is about to walk into the studio. It is, of course, my old friend George Gittos. It's always been dangerous doing the work that I do, but I'm George Gittos. There's always been an element of risk in everything. And George, heavens above, a regular on this program for over 20 years, is with me again in the studio to talk about his new film, White Light. I've been looking at it with absolute fascination. It is marvellous. It's a documentary set, as I said earlier, on the south side of Chicago, in a suburb with worse gun violence than any active war zone of the past two decades. George and his producer Helen Rose lived in Chicago for 18 months to make the film, and I have to say, Gladys and Potties, it is so powerful, so confronting, but absolutely essential. George, welcome back, and I'm glad you've survived.
Thank you. Well, we're heading back there again. I had the joy of a young boy who in 1968 went to join Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson, and sadly that was the year that he was killed, and to be back there closing down the Dan Ryan with Jesse Jackson last year, Jesse just feet away from me, my camera rolling, and Reverend Mike Flager there. So the spirit is still there. The dream might have been killed off in a lot of ways, but the courage is still there.
The style of the filming is really fascinating. It doesn't over-dramatise because what it's seeing is already so profoundly dramatic. It's not fast, it's not going quick cutting, there's no, it is a thoughtful, involving film.
Yeah, well, if you look at the changes in drama and cinema with these series that are now on Netflix and so on, you feel that you can let people breathe and get to know them, and you get a character like Soldier, who's been shot. He's the gang leader, the prince of the streets, and then you see him with his lovely partner Tia, and they're kissing, and they're in love, and it's trying to break with the kind of typecasting that you get in drama, and that's what you can do with documentary.
We're told that Black Deaths matter but they don't seem to matter a hell of a lot in this part of the world. No. And it's earned its name Chirac, hasn't it?
It certainly has. Like, very early in the film, little Dave, I ask him how many of his friends he's lost, and he says 20 to 30 since 2010. Well, everyone just about has lost that many people. Everyone. Helen went into the nail parlour with the other women, and every woman that was getting nails done had lost members of the family. One weekend we came back from being away, and there were four lots of crime scene tapes where people were being killed within 100 metres of my apartment, one where we park our car, one across the road, one near the church, and one on the other corner. It's shocking. And the thing that people tell you is that there's no good guys or bad guys. The little Mayblock gang that we're with say, George, you know, if you met the gang that we're fighting with, you'd like them as much as us. So the only solution, what we're going back for, is to try and put forward the idea of a moratorium to get everyone to see if they can go a weekend without any killings.
We've got time to tease this story out, so just describe the physicality of Englewood for us. Tell us about what Chirac looks like.
Well, it's shocking, Philip, in that Hyde Park, which is where Chicago University is lavishly rich, beautiful restaurants. And then within a very short, you know, just a few blocks, you go under a railway tunnel and you're in another country. In the in 1 year that we were there solidly, we did not see another white person except for Reverend Flager. Absolute segregation. And I've worked in South Africa. And it was never that bad in South Africa. And what it is what's enabling this level of racism and, you know, segregation is that people are frightened to go in there. And it is scary. You know, you go into that tunnel and every shop front doesn't have glass. Every building has got wood in front of them. There's a gang on every corner. And really the gangs are just medicating people. You know, one of our characters, Albert, says, you know, I don't smoke to get high, I smoke to get by.
We've got to emphasize that most of the violence we're discussing is black on black.
It's all, except for the police,
except,
and the police,
for the
are
cops.
Killing a lot of
people. One of your interviews is with a young shopkeeper from Yemen, and he thinks that Yemen is safer than this part of Chicago.
That's right. He said the only difference is that you get shot in Yemen and there's no hospital, but there is a hospital. But then it's almost that bad because there's no, although you've got all these deaths, there's no trauma unit. So most of the people die in the 20 minutes or so it takes to get to a hospital outside of Chirac where there is somewhere.
And we're talking about an area that's seen nearly twice the amount of civilian gun deaths than the number of US soldiers that have died in Iraq between 2003 and 2018.
Chirac. It's, and, you know, you go back to the time when you had all these great jazz musicians there and you had clubs and music was thriving, Coco Taylor and Howling Wolf and these people. You couldn't have that anymore. You can't have anywhere where people come together. When I first arrived, the gang at our block were all in jail. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to take the corner. So I'd go out and sit on the corner every day with my cup of tea, and that made a shopkeeper feel safe enough to open a sort of a takeout across the road. And I kind of, between the two of us, we made it safe. But then one period, I went away, he went away, and then there were all these killings and it reversed.
You know, we've talked in the past about your work in Afghanistan and your dealings with the Taliban. But how did you, the one white face, how did you get any degree of acceptance?
Well, people are fascinated by that. They think it would take ages. Like, Soldier and his gang are the most notorious gang. And I just went into their apartment with Wakar, who's my Afghan assistant. He's my cameraman with me. He's worked crazy. Wakar's worked with me for 12 years. And Helen's back there doing the music. the three of us. Anyway, walked in, and these guys, they have to assess someone within seconds because that person could kill them. So it only took them minutes to figure me out, and within the first 15 minutes...
God, I've never figured you out. I've known you for decades.
No, they can really figure me out. So when you first walk in, they're like a pack of wolves. Their hair goes up on the back of their neck, and they show their teeth. And if you show no fear, they, you know, fear in a way is a form of judgment. You know, even though they might be showing a ferocious side, if you see them as dangerous, then it's kind of judging them, you know, and I didn't do that. So we were filming within 15 minutes, and then a soldier mentioned that they had a guardian angel, Kaylin, this beautiful model.
Yes, let's tell that story.
Well, Kaylin was extraordinarily beautiful, and there's a company that sells cosmetics and beauty aids, and it's always white women who win it because there's no win. They had this competition, the Mario Make Me a Model competition. First time a black girl, she's just so beautiful, she had to win, she won. Came back to celebrate, tell her friends, and she was on a corner and she was shot and killed. And the whole community felt, finally someone's broken through, someone from the hood is going to make it. All their dreams were with her, and she was killed. And so, you know, the gangsters...
Why?
Well, it just... The sad thing was that the media, the white media, blamed the 15-year-old boy John John, who was with her. They said he was the real target. He was just a kid that she was kind to. And he was so hurt by that that it gave him kind of a breakdown. He wouldn't talk to anyone. He went into hiding. And one day I had him helping a cripple down into a car. I didn't know who he was. I was searching for the boy that was with Kaylin. He got into the car and I noticed a little patch of bandage on his stomach. And my intuition said, oh, did you know who was with Kaylin when she was killed? He said, but George, I thought you knew. It was me.
And, so now Kaylin is seen as some sort of guardian angel.
Yeah, she is.
A presence in the air.
A presence. And this goes right up to the high church with Reverend Flager. They all see her as that. And but, you know, it's a haunted place. Everyone's lost so many people. You'll see the drone footage over the graveyard. It just stretches and stretches and thousands of graves. And she's one of them.
You, I believe, opened a temporary South Chicago Yellow House.
That's correct. And it must be the ugliest, meanest, creative space on earth. It's under our apartments, and there's no light. It's the roof's all asbestos, and there's rats and everything else. But because we've got like the furnace of art going on there, painting, and, you know, I've brought a lot of the paintings back to Sydney to show here, they're all attracted to it because there's no art schools. You know that they've eliminated art, music, everything creative from the syllabus in the schools, and that's the one thing where African Americans have always achieved.
Who's so, eliminated it?
Well, it's just the mayor, the government. They've just taken, you know, they've felt that arts is sort of no use.
Where you see it, of course, is transformative.
Absolutely. In fact, the beautiful thing about the film is that if someone asked me at the Q&A after seeing the film about what's happened to Little Dave, to Little Mac, to Smiley, everyone that's closely involved in the film has been transformed by it. They've gotten jobs, they've gotten off parole. I don't know how many times I've been to court talking to judges to get the ankle bracelets removed from their legs so they could get around freely in the day.
George, how come the South Side of Chicago didn't benefit from the Obama years? Because that, of course, is where he made his political reputation.
Well, he did nothing, and Michelle Obama's from that area, and Chicago is Democratic, you know, is run by the Democrats, so they've got a lot to be ashamed about.
So the answer is he was just ignored.
It's very, very hard to justify that. They all had their hopes in him, and that was one of the hardest things for them to come to understand. They felt that Obama would be the one force that could change things, and it didn't happen.
George, how did you discover this story? you know, looking for trouble, clearly, which
no,
is
no,
what
I
you
don't
do.
Look for trouble, Philip, really. I felt that, you know, I'm torn. I love Yemen. You know, I've had an exhibition in Sana'a, and it's breaking my heart seeing what's happening in Yemen. But this was the America of Trump. You know, I've now been there for both his original victory and his midterm victory. And I felt, you know, America needs an Australian to go in there. Americans, there's nothing Americans hate more. We're going to have a hard time getting this seen anywhere in America than someone from outside, like an Aussie, saying, I can see what you're keeping covered up. There's an amazing scene in the film where the Utah gun exchange guy says, oh, so you're from Australian TV. That's where they took away your guns. And we show a picture of the Harbour Bridge.
There's another white guy in the story. You mentioned him already in passing.
Flaggy,
a white Catholic priest. Tell us about him.
He's one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. Martin Luther King's widow asked him to be the one who would speak in the last 6 minutes, you know, at the ceremony in Memphis. And St. Sabina Church is like, it's full of people. He's been there for years and years and years. And you go there and it's not really religion. I don't think Christ ever gets mentioned. It's like a group therapy session where they can actually go out and bring about change. You know, they're doing things, the youth and people are doing everything, but he's radical. So when we're there, I couldn't believe it. He suddenly said, well, you know, we've got to make these people listen. We're going to close down the Dan Ryan, which is the main freeway in America. And the day we turned up with a few thousand people, you know, protesters, there were even more cops, you know, like it was a real, they had their dogs. It was like something out of the 60s, you know, dogs on chains. And he did it. Just an incredibly brave activist.
One of the characteristics, one of the ingredients in your work has always been music. Tell us about that.
Well, that's my lovely Helen's been in charge of the music. She's Helen's dreamt all her life of being in the same place as Coco Taylor and Howling Wolf and all these people. And here we were, right, our apartment's right where their clubs and recording studios were. So she's worked with some of the best jazz musicians in that part of Southside Chicago and brought them together with our young street rappers. Maybe if you'll have me back sometime, we'll have Little Mac and Little Dave in here and they can rap a few of their street bits of music. So Helen's put that together. And it really is, you realise that in a place where self-esteem has been destroyed, they don't own anything, that the one thing they've got is their music and their dance. And every little corner gang has its homer. And so, like, for our gang, it's Little Mac and Little Dave. And so no matter what happens in their lives, by the afternoon they've written a poem, which is a rap song about it. And everyone feels special because they've now become part of an ode, you know, a piece of narrative music.
And you're hoping the film will help the great discussion about gun control.
We're really hoping that it makes a change in Chicago. You could show this film in New York or Sydney and it wouldn't make much difference. But in Chicago, we'll show it in churches and theatres and everywhere and put forward this idea of a moratorium. And we think that a moratorium could work.
Explain the concept.
Well, the concept is to say that if everyone acknowledges that it's a chain of violence and it's black people killing black people and the guys that are killing us are the same as we are and we're all, no one's good guys or bad guys, and what if we say, okay, you let down the whole community if we try and have a weekend where no one gets killed. If you take your gun out tonight, you're going to ruin it for everyone. And so that's the simple idea. So the film is going to be used to talk about that idea and show how crazy it all is.
I mentioned in introducing the program that you're a winner of the Sydney Peace Prize. You and quite a few other winners of that prize have signed a document pleading the case for Julian Assange. Now, I had forgotten that you actually did a painting of Julian, didn't you, in the embassy, in the Ecuadorian embassy?
Yeah, well, whenever Helen and I are in London, we go and see Julian and we take our shoes off and we sit down on the floor and we Helen takes him a nice homemade meal. And he's not the egotist that people are talking about. He's not a narcissist. He's just a nice Aussie. We bring a bit of Australia to him. And I did his portrait. And it's very disturbing to see what's happening. One of the things that worries me the most is that lots of our friends who are intellectuals in the left, they're in universities and so on, have all believed what this room full of CIA-type people have been put there to, you know, if they're going to spend, the English are going to spend £22 million just surveilling him. Imagine what the Americans are doing to ruin his reputation, to put out, you know, so that he's got no support.
Well, they've done a pretty good job. I can't tell you the number of people that email me, tweet, who have got absolutely not a scintilla of sympathy for Julian, including people who should know better.
That's right. Well, I've lectured at the Media Lab in MIT, you know, in Harvard, in Boston. And years later, you find that half the best students are emailing me, telling me that they're now working for someone equivalent to Blackwater and they're in Baghdad. And so a lot of these ideas of Chomsky and others like him on how you can be manipulated, that's what they're doing. You know, the latest thing is that Julian's supposed to be a Russian spy. or, you know, I've had people who I really respect telling me that he's a misogynist. Well, Helen's got a good nose for a misogynist, and she's been in the embassy many times with Julian, and he's anything but. They've done a great job at turning those who could support him against him.
And now, of course, they're topping it up with espionage charges.
That's right.
There's 17 could have him in charges. Prison for about five life terms.
That's right. Well, when Julian and I are together, we live down at Werri Beach, and I get him to imagine coming and staying with me. I've offered to told everyone that I'll look after him. If we can get him back to Australia, he can stay with us at Werri. And he loves to imagine swimming the beach with me. And his mother went to Jeringong Primary School. And so all I can say is, someone who's a pretty good judge of character, I've had to judge people in order to survive all my life. And Julian is a good person. He's not what they're saying he is. And he certainly deserves our support.
Where's the portrait?
Well, the portrait, we can't reveal it, but it's about to go on display at a very public venue, and we're going to have talks about Julian around it. It's huge. We did it in two panels, and you know, taking those panels into the embassy and painting Julian from life. It's not something from photographs. I think it's one of the most important things I've done, because it was about his predicament. And of course, no artist can go back there. I've had a lot of criticism for doing it. You know, I entered it in the Archibald, it wasn't hung. I entered in a couple of other things, it wasn't hung. And I say to people, what about Holbein's wonderful portrait of Henry VIII? He cut off the heads of all these wives, but we're still glad that Holbein painted it, you know, and exists. And it's very important that I got in there and painted it with Julian.
Okay, back to Chicago.
Yep.
What would you like to happen as a consequence of the film? Because you are going to stream the response from Australia back to them, aren't you? Are you not?
What I'd like to see happen is all my characters from Southside end up on the red carpet in the Chicago Film Festival. So the strongest...
In wheelchairs, some of them.
A lot of them in wheelchairs. You know, like Dear Soldier, he had a gun planted on him, and that's his charge. He's in a wheelchair. He's paralysed. He's been shot in the back, and yet they've still got an ankle bracelet on him, you know, like he's some threat to society. And... you have them there, and it's going to be interesting to see whether you know, the basically the white intellectuals that run the festival are going to be prepared to show it. And if they don't, we'll show it at St. Sabina and other churches and embarrass them. But the strongest thing, I think, in our film is at the end where you see little Dave and little Mac on the ferry going down the big river that goes through the centre of Chicago. Yeah. And there's all these very wealthy white people in their yachts and motorboats and everything, partying with glasses of champagne and bikinis. And you see a few cops lounging around having a good time as well. And just the contrast is extreme. No one from the South. They're more isolated in Southside Chicago than if they were in Africa. It's another world.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, no one ever comes out. And I've had the experience that, like, there's a university-educated artist who works with me, and we've gone, for example, to an art store, a simple thing, where I walk in and select my art materials. If he goes off with a basket to get his, suddenly two security guards stand on either side of him and have to put the things in, and then follow him up to the cash register to make sure he pays for them. And then we've gone to go to a restaurant in normal Chicago, where I would normally eat, which is attached to the Museum of Contemporary Art, and been told that he can only sit outside, he can't sit inside. So it really is Jim Crow segregation in a way that Australians think has gone. But, you know, it's much worse than it was. I was there 50 years ago. It's much worse than it was 50 years ago.
Where next for George?
Well, I haven't usually, you know, I made three films in Afghanistan. I'm going to do another one on the South Side. And then Yemen, I mean, I'm torn. I feel guilty that I'm not working in Yemen. You know, what's happening there? Like, the way America's backing the Saudis, you know, we know what's happened in Saudi Arabia, and they're, you know, helping them destroy this poor country of Yemen. Like, Sana's most beautiful city on earth. They don't allow cars. It's ancient. And, you know, it's just, I've got to be working in Yemen.
The voice of George Gittoes, artist, remarkable filmmaker, and a long-term friend of our program. His new documentary film, White Light, will be shown at the Sydney Film Festival on the 7th of June. And this is good news. It gets a theatrical release in August. You simply must see it.
And the paintings are on too in Woollahra over the period.
That's it from LNL. Tomorrow, Bruce Shapiro. And I'll be talking to Iris Mackler, who has put together a beautiful book of recipes and stories from Holocaust survivors around the world. See you then.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.